Good evening. Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. My name is Garland Nixon, and I'm here with
Mark Levine.
And you're listening to News Views. News Views is on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. We talk about all of the latest news stories that are important, and try to find things that maybe you haven't heard, or things that are very important. I imagine we're going to have to talk about the findings from the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
That won't be. I imagine within the next couple of weeks we're going to have to talk about that on the show.
Yeah. Well, the oral argument occurred this week. The findings probably won't happen until June.
Yeah. So, but that's coming. That's going to be some. That'll be some interesting shows. We'll have to get some really good guests. Some really good guests in for that. But today we're talking about an article that was in the Washington Post here a few days ago, and I believe we have with us Mr. Fred Tutman. Are you there, Fred?
Yeah, I'm right here on the line.
And Fred is the river keeper for the Patuxent River, and he has an interesting article called Within Mainstream Environmentalist Groups, Diversity is Lacking. An excellent article that applies to other groups. But basically what they're talking about is environmental groups that aren't inclusive. They don't have diversity. And as a result of not having diversity, they don't necessarily address a lot of the issues that some of the minority communities are concerned with. So let's start with Mr. Tubman. Fred, I'm sure all of our listeners want to know exactly what a river keeper is. What is the Patuxent River Keeper?
So I'm a guardian for the state of Maryland's longest and deepest intrastate river. It runs 110 miles through seven counties. The river keepers are licensed by a group in New York City. And there are about 200 of us worldwide, each one of us responsible for a particular waterway. We advocate, we're community organizers, we litigate against polluters, mm-hmm. try to get better laws to protect the waterways.
Oh, that's interesting. Great.
Is there one person in charge of the Mississippi? I'm just curious. Does that get several people?
Oh, there are a bunch of folks down the Mississippi and the Gulf.
I was going to say, that'd be a long river to be in charge of, the entire Mississippi River.
Yeah, some of these are bifurcated. Like there's an upper and a lower James River in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
At various times there have been people on the upper and the lower of the Susquehanna.
Well, I want to know who's in charge of the Potomac, because it's awfully polluted, and I have a word to say to them.
Yeah, well, actually, there is a very good Potomac River Keeper. He's relatively new. The founding River Keeper retired in January of this year. So the guy who's on the Potomac is just getting up to speed, but he's very up to the job.
They're always warning me I can't swim in this beautiful river outside of Washington, D.C., because it's really dangerous. And so I assume that one of the roles for River Keeper is to try to keep people from dumping pollutants upstream that float downstream next to people like me.
Well, yeah, we're trying to also build a buzz. We're trying to get other people involved in this task of saving and protecting these wonderful rivers that people love, that people feel connected to. Like you said, you feel connected to the Potomac.
Well, you know, your article is a very important article for a number of reasons that we're going to be able to discuss tonight today. But it was a Washington Post article, Within Mainstream Environmentalist Groups, Diversity is Lacking. And for starters, I understand you are the only black river keeper, or African-American, whatever term someone chooses to use, worldwide of all the river keepers. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, with the important distinction that's African-American. There's an African river keeper in Senegal.
Okay,
and
sure.
There are other people of color. There are people who have tribal ancestry around. But African-American is a distinction.
Yeah.
That's what they tell me.
Okay. Yes. A big discussion on the whole black African-American here in this country, those terms, but that's a whole nother show. But this one, so I understand that in looking at this article, you know, I picked up that there is a bit of frustration, you know, within the African-American environmentalist community. There's a bit of frustration with the lack of diversity and some of the issues that lack of diversity creates within the larger, predominantly white environmentalist groups. What is that frustration about? Tell me about it, how it came about.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, certainly there's the question of whether there's inclusiveness in the hiring practices of mainstream environmental groups. But I think, at least more to my area of concern, is that the work being done by large, well-funded mainstream groups doesn't particularly touch or benefit communities of color or poor communities in the same way that they tend to serve very empowered and environmentally well-off folks. You know, in the Chesapeake Bay, the the constituents of the well-funded organizations tend to be range from waterfront land dwellers, people who sail and, you know, have access in a particular way, a sense of entitlement to natural resources. There's a real disconnect, I think, between where the worst problems are in the environment and where the bulk of the focus is for the large mainstream groups. I would argue that the mainstream groups tend to serve the 1%, mm-hmm. or at least the folks who are major donors. Mm-hmm. You know, grassroots folks are doing different work, and I think people of color are doing grassroots work in their own communities. They're on their own, frankly, because there's no rescue in sight for the, you know, these massive toxic hazards that disproportionately affect communities of color.
Ms. Tuttle, I'd be curious about who, or if there is, a riverkeeper for the Anacostia River. Of course, Washington, D.C. is founded on the banks of two rivers, the Potomac and the Anacostia, but the Anacostia goes through southeast, goes through Prince George's County. It goes through a, you know, some heavily African American areas, and I'd be curious, Mr. Tutman, if that river at least, which would have dramatic concerns to African American communities in this area, whether there's a riverkeeper there.
There's absolutely a very effective riverkeeper on the Anacostia, very engaged with the communities that he serves, very concerned about environmental justice. There's actually a heritage of waterkeepers. Several waterkeepers have served on the Anacostia, and the latest, I think, would be certainly among the folks who really do care about this stuff.
I'd just be surprised that if it's a white person, just because the communities that largely live around the Anacostia tend to be black. Not that that's not a good person, but I'd be surprised that, particularly in rivers that go through heavily black communities, you would think that people from those communities would want to serve as waterkeepers.
Sure. Well, the current serving waterkeeper on the Anacostia happens to be white. There have been others in the past that were not on the Anacostia. But I tend to approach these issues more as have and have not. I don't think they're really black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are questions of power and those who have power and who do not. I think there are questions of grassroots versus those who are working from the ground up as opposed to those who are working from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's much more meaningful because it's hard to generalize. Like, I can't say with authority that black environmentalists all think a certain way, no more than I could say that about white environmentalists. It just depends.
One of the important things that comes out in this article, and it's a term I heard you use a moment ago, and that is environmental justice. You know, there is environmental groups, there are environmental groups, and the ones that are geared, the ones that have a very significant minority presence tend to be environmental justice, and they tend to look at things differently. One of the things that I picked up in the article that maybe you can expound upon a bit was that the mainstream environmental groups tend to look at, you know, let's have clean water, let's have clean air, let's save the old growth forest, etc. And some of the issues that I saw, the environmental justice, organizations that were significantly mostly people of color, there's two particular things that stood out here that they dealt with. And one of them was, it says, Robert Buller of Texas Southern University said that in 1980, all five of Houston's landfills were in minority communities, as were six of the city's eight incinerators. He said mainstream environmental groups he approached for help did not seem concerned. It says the environmental justice movement started with a battle in Warren, North Carolina in 1982. The state selected a largely black township as a site for a landfill to dump more than 30,000 cubic yards of soil contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, most people know as PCBs.
Yeah.
It said the residents lost, and minority environmentalists said they never forgot that mainstream conservation groups did not help. Now, and I don't want this, you know, of course, all of us, we don't want this to be, let's beat up on the environmental groups, because we are all very much in favor and supportive of what they're doing. But I do see an issue here where there are some other concerns, the environmental concerns, that without a significant diverse presence, an environmental group may not look at, you know, the plights of maybe poor people or black people, et cetera, who are dealing with some slightly different environmental concerns or unique environmental concerns for our community, if you would.
Well, sure. I agree with everything you said. I think that environmental organizations that are funded, they work on what funds them. And the funding of people who have lots of resources, the donors who have lots of resources, have a whole different idea circumstantially about what an environmental problem is. If you're poor or if you're black in America, I assure you, your circumstances matter quite a bit in terms of what the environment is for you. I think large mainstream groups think of the environment typically as raw nature. So they're basically saving, again, waterfronts and mountains and national parks and, you know, places that are relatively pristine. I think communities of color are often hanging on for dear life because they're on the, they're dealing with an onslaught of toxic hazards and unfair practices that selectively are very particularly affect these communities of color. So the environmental mainstream movement, I think, tries very hard to be colorblind. And that's a little absurd because the culture we live in is not colorblind when it comes to where the pollution goes. Your lifespan, your longevity is actually influenced as much by the zip code and where you live than whether or not you recycle and, you know, do all these very voluntary practices on your own.
So let's take the example that Garland just gave of landfills in Houston. So I presume, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, but I presume that there's no way out of a landfill, that every community needs a landfill, that toxic PCBs have to go somewhere. And maybe they don't. And if they don't, please inform me of that. But it seems to me that you're always going to have a landfill. And usually the corporate interests are going to go for the cheapest land possible. And the cheapest land is in the poorest neighborhood. That's not a good thing to be sure, but it is, I mean, should they go in uninhabited areas? Is that what you're arguing? Or do you actually think we can get rid of landfills entirely?
No, I'm saying that the political quantum of where a noxious land use goes, they don't go in Potomac, Maryland, all right? They don't go in wealthy, empowered areas. They go in areas where people have relatively less power to influence what goes in their community. So every community does not have a landfill. In fact, some communities, many communities, would rather shift their waste elsewhere, anywhere but here. And that's where the whole term NIMBY, you know, comes from.
Right, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. But is there a place, like, could we ship them all? I don't know. I think of Nevada because I think of that as mostly empty desert, apart from Las Vegas and a few cities. But then I remember when we wanted to ship our nuclear waste to Nevada, Nevadans were like, well, we don't want it here. I guess my question is sort of a practical one. Assuming it has to go somewhere, how should a society fairly determine where it goes? I mean, there are people who are internationalists. They would say ship it to Bangladesh, but
right.
That's not fair to the people in Bangladesh.
Well, let me throw something in there, and that is there's one very significant issue also that arises, and that's money. Because if you are shipping the trash over long, long distances, needless to say, the cost of trash removal goes through the roof, which, of course, is going to be another issue.
So I guess that's my question, yeah. Mr. Tupman. What would be your fair solution to what seems to be the problem of nobody wants it in their backyard?
I think any community has to have some deliberative way of assigning how land gets used and where certain land uses get put, the same way they'd consider where libraries and schools and other man-made infrastructure go.
Yep.
What I'm pointing out is that deliberative process tends to break down when it involves communities without power.
Yeah, and let me, for both of you may not know this, but there was a time in my earlier years where I worked with the state of Maryland, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, worked on loan with them, and I did investigations. We investigated toxic waste dumping, illegal toxic waste dumping, and toxic removal sites, etc. And there are some hard and fast criteria that can be used, such as, if you have an area that's very sandy, where the waste material are more likely to leach through that sand to the aquifer, et cetera, as opposed to an area where there's hard clay land and it's less likely. So if you look at an area and say, well, you know, the area, they can use criteria that have nothing to do with the community or the political power. They can look at the type of ground and say, well, we're going to put landfills or toxic materials or wherever, where there is clay or hard rock or something, where it's less likely to be a problem. And I think one of the things that you see is those types of objective criteria kind of melt away, and it comes down to, well, you know, we may have a lot more clay in our land, but, you know, houses are selling for $2.8 million.
Nobody wants it in their backyard. That's why, even the example of Nevada that I gave that example because it's mostly empty desert, but Nevadans don't want it either. I just see it as a lose-lose battle where everyone fights to say, not me.
Let me ask Mr. Tupman a question. I think one of the things that you're getting at in this article is this. The discussion that we're having is a valid discussion. But because the mainstream environmental groups don't have diversity, if they had people of color, and not just people of color, we're talking class.
Socioeconomic, yeah, poor people.
If they had poor people, people of color, etc., with inculcated within their organizations, this discussion would be had, but because there is not diversity in either class or race or ethnicity, etc., they're not having these conversations. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, yes, and bingo. And I think the flip side of this is it's not uncommon for mainstream environmentalists, typically white, to come up to me and say, look, we've been inviting black folks to these meetings for years and they don't show up. They don't come. So they must not be environmentalists. Which strikes me as kind of bizarre, because all of the communities that I work with, white, color, white, black, whatever, everybody's interested in the environment. I think the forum of where you bring your concerns matters greatly in terms of, again, relative power. If you have to go to a meeting in someone else's community, if you're on terrain that is uneven at its face, mm-hmm. If you're going to be indoctrinated rather than listened to, then I think that there's less of a likelihood that the communities will come together and work in unison as a team on these issues. But it's just bizarre for me to constantly hear that black folks don't care about the environment. I don't know anybody who doesn't care about the environment.
I think you should respond to them. I got a great place in Anacostia or Baltimore or a bunch of areas I can think of in this country, Prince George's County, Maryland. Let's host the meeting there, and yes. Let's see who shows up.
And well, the other part of it is, and I think this is important, and you know, this is not just, I mean, within environmental groups, but within, there are a number of, and I've spoken about this with friends of mine before, and some people on the Hill. There are a number of groups, left-leaning groups, groups on the left, that while they are mean well and they have great intentions, they don't have diversity within the staff, particularly at the highest levels. They don't have African Americans, very few working with the organizations, and they really have virtually no one in a decision-making, on a decision-making level, on an administrative level. So you don't have people who are comfortable saying, let's invite these people to be part of the organization. Let's have a diversity in the people who make the decisions as to what we're going to address and who talk about everything, rather than just saying, let's have a meeting with this 99% white organization that is the entire administrative staff is white. Let's bring some black people in there and listen to them and then send them about their merry way.
Well, yes, and I agree. Let's be clear. If these mainstream groups were heavily populated by people of color, I assure you the work that they would be doing, the issues, the priorities, would be substantially different. And I think that's an unwelcome feature. I think we're welcome to the table to the extent that we present diversity, the appearance of inclusiveness. But at the point we start lobbying and arguing for refocusing of the issues on those matters that particularly affect communities of color, I think that scene is disingenuous. It's seen as competing for the resources. The issue that is very hot right now, one of the issues that's very hot in the Chesapeake Bay area, is pollution trading, right? So, which on its face strips environmental wealth from one community and allocates it elsewhere. And there's a lot of buy-in amongst the mainstream movement of why pollution trading is good money raising and all this stuff. But inevitably, if you're trading something, A, that doesn't belong to you in the first place, but also you're creating a marketplace for where people can pay for the privilege of polluting, I assure you that pollution is going to go in those communities least able to fight back, least able to resist it. And the credit, the wealth generated by the trade, will inevitably go to those empowered communities that actually aren't that off to begin with. So that's an example of a situation where the demographics of a movement completely skews, completely changes its perspective on where the problems are, what the priorities need to be.
Mr. Tupman, if I could continue the river metaphor here, you swam upstream. I mean, you are the only African-American riverkeeper. You're clearly standing out and protecting the Patuxent River in a mostly white environment. How is it that you believe that you managed to, well, infiltrate's too strong a word, but let's just say divert, make the riverkeepers in this circumstance, this environmental organization, more diverse? And what can people learn from your experience in terms of opening it up to others?
Well, I try pretty hard in my work to serve all of the communities. I don't look at a community and say, oh, there's a black community, I'm going to work harder for those guys. That's just not how my mind works. I do think that my perspective as an African-American with strong cultural ties to the earth, I grew up on a family farm, you know, did all the Boy Scout hiking, backpacking, all that stuff too. But I do believe that my particular slice of it is very context rich, because I believe that African-Americans have a particular heritage of connecting to land in America. It's not one that's recognized for the, often enough by, I think, mainstream groups, because it doesn't look like recreational stuff. It doesn't look like skiing and sailing and all that stuff.
Looks like farming, sharecropping.
Exactly. It's toil on land and being in touch with the rhythms of the earth. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a very rich, layered heritage that I think we have, that I think some African-Americans have lost sight of.
Well,
lost touch of as a practical matter.
Another thing I think that is important about that, that I think we need to touch, kind of get back to very briefly, about the discussion of the effect that diversity has in an organization, the effect that it has, that diversity, whether it's race, ethnicity, et cetera, a gender, brings diversity of thought. And the reason I thought about that is because it's not like the African Americans are saying we want to take over this environmental club, you know, organization and change everything they're doing. Basically, what it sounds like to me, such as with the Chesapeake Bay issues, I think one of the things that we are saying as African Americans, that African American people are saying, is that if there was diversity, if there were more African American people within the mainstream groups, when they made decisions such as how do we decide where things are going to go? How do we decide what we're going to support, or what we're going to support, where things should be, or how things should work? That they would have someone there saying, well, one of the considerations you should take when deciding your position is this. African Americans have this, and we're concerned that if this happens, all this stuff's going to be dumped on our community. So when you're making your decisions, take into account that if you do this, 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 or move in this direction, it's possible that the powers that be may just dump them all in our community. So sometimes I think one of the things that we're getting at here is diversity of thought brings diversity of opinion, and it brings to light the concerns of people, not necessarily just changing the entire direction of an environmental group, but it will bring to light different concerns that they're not able to address now because they don't have anyone saying these things to them.
Yes, I totally believe that you're right about that. I believe that there are social expectations attached to who we are identified as culturally. I know, because I've been working on the Appalachian Trail for 14 years, and when I walk along the trail, and there are a bunch of white environmentalists or trail workers in front of me who don't know me, they often, and I used to think it was a courtesy, like, oh, why don't you go walk ahead, you know, they'll say. And I began to realize that actually some folks are really uncomfortable with an unknown black guy walking along behind them out in the wilderness. They think that's something really edgy about that.
But wow.
I also know that it's tough to talk about race stuff. Right? Because people will think you're paranoid, or you're playing the race card, or you're creating divisiveness. But let's be clear, I think we are divided. I think the nation is divided in so many ways around class and about race and perspective.
And it sounds like, and also what you're saying is this is a way to bridge those divides, to bring them together, to bring people together. And the other thing about race and class is this, and I didn't really get into this a lot, but within the article, that's one of the things you talk about, and that is a lot of the mainstream environmental groups. You know, not only are they, you know, majority white groups, but they're people of significant means, shall we say.
And I do think it's a class issue.
Yes.
I think there are a lot of black people that are too busy struggling against socioeconomic pressures, just trying to make a living, or working in unions to do that, or working in NAACP or other organizations. My question was whether there are certain environmental groups, maybe in African American churches or as part of, say, the NAACP or something, where there's already sort of an institution of African American environmentalists that could rejoin the Sierra Club if those groups are out there. They could combine and work together. Is there anything like that that's out there?
Well, yeah, there are all kinds of groups who are doing, outreach. Of course, the analogy I made earlier with missionaries, there are quite a number of them that are trying to get people of color on their bandwagon, which is how the funding mechanisms work too, right? Somebody writes a grant, they want to do outreach, they want to convert people. There are far fewer opportunities for folks who want to absorb the agendas that already exist within communities. What I call compassionate environmentalism. Environmentalism that helps people and communities as opposed to kind of nebulous issues that you can't touch, you know, climate change, which obviously is very, very important. But it doesn't touch people in quite the same way as something happening in their front yard or in their immediate community.
Right. So you for example, I just say, if there's an Anacostia neighborhood association that's worried about the pollution, and Anacostia used to be one of the most polluted rivers in the country, I think it's actually getting a little bit better now, but maybe that neighborhood organization could join hands with the Sierra Club and work together. Is that possible?
And I think one of the things it's saying, if I may, Fred, I think one of the things that's being said here is that that's articulated in this article is that a number of African-American environmental organizations started, and the reason they started was because they didn't want separate groups. They wanted to be a part of the mainstream groups. They wanted to join in as members of these various groups and be part of the groups, but they found that the door was slammed on them, that they weren't really brought in, and in many instances, African-American professionals didn't, you know, get hired by them, and they felt that they were on the outside, and they created African-American environmental groups out of necessity because they felt. Is that kind of the way it happened, Fred?
Well, yeah, that's my take on it as well. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what the deal is. But don't overlook, again, the distinction, again, between groups that serve communities, and I consider those to be grassroots, and groups that serve an issue. Mm-hmm. Right, they're polarized or focused entirely on a single issue, so they don't want anything to do with you if you're not interested in the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right, there's a whole cadre of folks within the Bay Area, for example, that care nothing about you unless you care about the Chesapeake Bay. So you're irrelevant, you're invisible, you're off the grid as far as they're concerned if you don't care about the same things. And but again, the point is your circumstances sometimes realistically influence exactly what you care about.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. You cannot ignore someone's circumstances. Of course, in the general society, a lot of folks assume that you're responsible for your own circumstances. So poor people live in really bad places because they didn't work hard, right? Because
right.
they don't get up and pick up the trash. I mean, these are, I think, very absurd. I'm being facetious.
They are absurd.
Right.
But the idea is that sometimes people don't have control over their circumstances.
So
the reason they may not seem to care about the environment is because they have a really lousy environment to begin with.
Right, and it certainly sounds to me like these are things that need to be addressed, and I think it's good that we're talking about it on this show, because I'm sure there may be people listening to this show in the environmental movement who feel offended. I'm guaranteeing
well,
there's somebody out there who feels
in.
Offended or who feels attacked when in fact what's being said here is something that can strengthen the environmental movement, that when whoever it is, the Sierra Club, because here's what I hear, two things. I hear that there's a mainstream environmental movement that deals with the environment in a broad spectrum of ways. And there's another environmental group that deals with people and how they are affected in a negative way on a more, you know, personal level. And that that I think the inference I'm getting from this article is that people of color and people of lesser means are saying, we don't want to have to be on the outside. Why don't we just, can't we be a part of these organizations? And these organizations can still focus on what they focus on, but they can use their considerable means to also take a part or a small part to focus on the other issues that deal with people also.
Well, yeah, and as you can imagine, people get very hot under the collar if they presume that what I'm saying is that the work of mainstream groups isn't important or isn't worthwhile. And that's actually not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's not the same work
right.
as grassroots groups are inclined to do, and that we don't all benefit in exactly the same way from activities that improve clean air and clean water.
Let me stop you for a minute here. We're going to have to take a break. We're at halfway through the hour. You're listening. We'll be right back. Hold tight there, Fred. We're talking with Fred Tutman, who has had an article in the Washington Post, within mainstream environmental groups, diversity is lacking. You're listening to 89.3 WPFW here in Washington, D.C. Garland Nixon and Mark Levine. We're here on News Views. It's on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Hold on there, Fred. And once again, let me give out the number, 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. We want to hear from you. We'll be back in a minute.